Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to. In my room, in my room, in my room.
Okay, Kat, you can start to fade. That, of course, is Brian Wilson's great ode to solitude. We're going to do a show today. It's nominally about hermits. Although, I mean, that's a very loosely applied and poorly understood word. It's maybe more a show about solitude. Either way, we're going to do a show about something you're experiencing more of right now than usual, and also potentially less than usual. In other words, if you're at home right now with other people, maybe you're with them more than you're accustomed to being. So a little of both. You may feel like a hermit and like somebody who doesn't get a chance at solitude at all. All at the same time, everything contains its own opposite. Heraclitus was right. And, you know, here in America, I also feel like we have, because everything in America is performative, I think we have the most performative hermits. I mean, I think Thoreau in particular was a very gregarious, people-oriented hermit who really wanted people to know that he was engaging in acts of solitude. And even Salinger, you know, famously a person who withdrew from society, except that everybody in Cornish, New Hampshire knew him. They all knew Jerry. They were very artful at giving people from out of town bad directions to where he lived. He wasn't really seeking solitude. He was just trying to get away from a certain kind of person. So we're going to talk about this in a much more pervasive and ideally profound way with three terrific guests today. We're going to begin with Stephen Batchelor. He is a Buddhist teacher and writer. He's the author of several books, including Buddhism Without Beliefs, A Contemporary Guide to Awakening, and most recently and most relevantly, The Art of Solitude. He's the co-founder of Bodhi College, and he is joining us, I believe, from France. So first of all, Stephen Batchelor, good day or night.
Well, it's actually early evenings, but I realize it's your afternoon. So good afternoon, Colin. It's a pleasure to be on this show.
So where you are right now is not too far from the home of Montaigne, someone with whom you have intellectually communed 500 years removed. And he is one of the people who points us towards some value of solitude. And I know as we're sitting here in the midst of the pandemic, you feel as though Montaigne, with his experiences with the plague, may have something to teach us as well. So give us a little tour through that.
Well, you're right. I live about 40 minutes by car from the tower and the castle in which Montaigne spent all those years in solitude. Although, as you were saying about Thoreau, Montaigne likewise was in solitude, but he was also very much involved with the world at the same time. And Montaigne has always struck me as someone who stands as a wonderful example of a person who's willing to take the risk of cutting himself off from the world at one level and having the courage to look into the nature of his own mind, his emotions, his thoughts, his desires, his fears, and to study that rather than be somewhat bored or lonely or whatever it might be. He actually becomes profoundly interested in what is going on inside himself. And I think many of us today, if we're not used to the experience of being solitude, the experience of solitude, we might find that one of the most unnerving aspects of it is that we're confronted with our own subjectivity, our own inwardness, as Kierkegaard called it, and we may find that we're not particularly as skilled at dealing with some of the stuff that comes bubbling up or sometimes comes racing up. Montaigne, when he first went into his tower, thought it would be kind of straightforward to just sit down, look at his books, and then everything would be hunky-dory. But in fact, he said what happened was that he looked at his mind and his mind was completely out of his control. He said it races off like a galloping horse with no design or plan. And this led him into many years, really, of deep introspection and fascination with the workings of his own interiority. And what he has to say about solitude, I think, has a really universal relevance that is not just confined to his period in history or his particular personal experience, but I found it really does allow us to see what solitude is like. And also, he gives us endless numbers of very good tips as to how to cope with it. So he's become a bit of a hero for me. I also, of course, admire the fact that he didn't seal himself off from the world, but he constantly kept an awareness and active involvement, in fact, in some of the political issues of his day. And as you mentioned, he had to deal with things like the plague. When the plague struck Bordeaux in 1585, a small city at the time, probably population less than 50,000 or so, 14,000 people died in a six-month period, which kind of puts our coronavirus mortality rate into a different sort of perspective. Yes. Montaigne also fled. The plague surrounded his castle, and he went off for 6 months in a carriage with his wife and his daughter and some servants, no doubt, and had to cope with solitude. He had to cope with the plague. Mm. And I think the solitude he'd experienced wasn't something that sealed him off from the world. It actually allowed him a sort of personal stability and clarity of mind in which he was able to respond more appropriately, more immediately, more decisively perhaps, with the situation in which he found himself in this case, surrounded by plague. He was also surrounded by war. He was right in the midst of the world's turmoil. And yet the solitude comes to be understood not as a separating yourself off from these things, but rather a separating yourself off from the habits of your mind that are constantly preoccupying you, constantly sending you off on wild goose chases of fantasy and paranoia and so forth and so on. And in this respect, solitude becomes a means whereby to get to grips with who you are and to find a more stable and more honest way to encounter not only your own inner life, but also the life that's going on all around you.
Right. If Montaigne had the awareness to bring a yoga mat up into his tower, he would have known that he was experiencing the monkey mind at first. Instead of the galloping horse. So at the beginning of your book, you quote Victor Hugo saying that that solitude is hell. So bumping up against that, sort of, we have Sartre in No Exit saying hell is other people, which doesn't give us too many options to escape hell. Except that Sartre, when he clarifies that thought later, he says what he really means, and it's very close to something that you just said, Stephen. What he really means is that with other people present, you can't truly know yourself. You can't confront yourself because your idea of your own self is it incorporates the judgments other people have made about you and are making about you. That's the problem with other people. So presumably the first person you meet in solitude, the first presence you encounter, is yourself. Is that a fair statement, that's who you're alone with for the first time?
Yes, indeed it is. And of course, it's not, solitude is not a special condition of certain hermits and others who decide to separate themselves from the world. Solitude is the condition in which we are born and the condition in which we spend a lot of our life anyway, whatever we're doing. There's always a part of ourselves, even in the midst of a busy meeting, even as we're listening to this radio show, perhaps, in which you're paying attention to what's going on all around you, but there's a part of you that somehow takes a certain distance, that observes yourself observing what's going on, that is self-reflective, self-aware. And as long as there is other stuff going on around you, you can kind of manage that quite well. But when you are suddenly removed from all of these inputs and stimuli, all these other people and so on, you become much more acutely aware of your inner stuff, as it were, your inner life. And it's at that point that you do begin to realize that so much of who you think you are is very often constituted of the voices of your parents or your teachers or other figures you admire, who are kind of running a sort of a background commentary that constitutes in many ways what you tell yourself about yourself. And so I think what Montaigne and others have found is that actual solitude provides us an opportunity to begin to tease apart those voices which are really the internalized voices of others, and to begin to identify those that inner quiet voice that is really the voice of your own soul, we might say, that is finding itself. Keats, in his poetry, talks of the experience of solitude as being dialogical. It's you talking to yourself, you thinking your thoughts. It's not just a one-dimensional state at all. It always consists of a certain kind of voice. And that voice you begin over time to refine. And as a writer, and as an artist perhaps, I think we find that it's in solitude that we begin to discover our own voice, our own way of seeing the world, that's less and less inflected by the opinions and the views of our society and of others who have been a great influence on us.
It really is amazing how much, how often, how consistently among creative people this just keeps coming up. You write a lot about painters, about Vermeer and about Agnes Martin. But yes, it's in Keats. Obviously, it's in Wordsworth, of whom you appear to be very fond, but the world is too much with us. There is this kind of notion that if you are going to get to anything true, whether it's an apprehension of true beauty or an apprehension of yourself or something, you are somehow or other going to have to approach the state that you're talking about right now, Stephen, right? This notion of somehow or other cutting off some of those other ties and silencing some of those other voices.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think this has been what monasteries and other such institutions have served in the past. It's an opportunity to have a place, a safe place, where you can retreat, where you can enter into a more contemplative dialogue with who you are. And again, I think it's important not to restrict this to monks and hermits and so forth, for which it is perhaps best known, but also to recognize that many of our greatest philosophers, more recently, one would think perhaps of Nietzsche, of Kierkegaard, of Heidegger, all of whom, and Wittgenstein, all of whom spent deliberate periods of time very much by themselves and on their own. But also artists. I feel that the artist in his or her studio is in a very, very solitary space. My brother's an artist working in London. He's not particularly interested in meditation and things like that, but he very much resonates with the discourse on solitude, that he finds himself struggling with his work in an environment where he's entirely alone, and yet that aloneness allows him to enter into a much deeper and richer dialogue with his paintings and with his sculptures that he's refining and creating there in the world. And Agnes Martin talks of how she paints with her back to the world. In other words, there's something about the solitude of the artist's studio, of the writer's retreat, of the monk's cell, that enables another kind of discourse to begin to emerge.
You know, you've done so much more in the way of this than I have, but one of my kind of minor experiences of this happened, oddly enough, about 200 kilometers west of where you are right now. I went on a solo bicycle trip that started up around Sarlat and Souillac and then south and ended in Cahors. And I was alone. And I mean, I stopped at inns, you know, to stay for the night, but my French is bad. And I just was increasingly aware that I was alone. I was alone out on the road. And I was frequently lonely, which I had not expected to be. But at the end of it all, I turned in my bicycle that I'd rented from this tour company in Cahors. And as you probably know, there's a kind of famous bridge in Cahors, the Pont de Valentre. And I walked out on it and I started to cry, like really cry. And it was about the beauty that I'd experienced. And all just suddenly, these days and days and days of being in this incredible countryside with these incredible natural splendors, it just made me weep in a way that I don't think I ever had before. And I think it did have something to do with the solitude part, the aloneness part, the fact that there wasn't anybody else mediating or moderating my experience of the world. And so, you know, when I read what you write about the these visual artists, I think probably if you want to see beauty and color and light, you'd best try to do it without a lot of outside interference.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's also something reported by people who go on meditation retreats and they spend, let's say, a week in silent meditation. And very often after a couple of days and the mind begins to sort of quieten down, you're not talking to people, so there's no inputs, all that sort of dies down too. And often it's rather surprising that suddenly the world appears to you more radiant, the colors appear more bright, the sounds appear more sharp and distinct, and very often people do feel these strong aesthetic experiences that brings them to the edge of tears. There's something profoundly moving about letting the mind quieten down, letting go of all of the inputs from our devices and our media and our friends and our family. And we begin to realize that all of that noise is actually something that serves as a kind of an anesthetic. It actually dulls the senses. And once that begins to die down, no doubt as it did for you as you bicycled through that part of France, is exactly that. But when the mind begins to quieten down, when things begin to still, it's not just a negative experience of having somehow lost something, chatter, but in the loss of that chatter, there is allowed the capacity for the senses to be profoundly enriched and sharpened. Of course, there is tumult of other things too. As you mentioned, loneliness is the shadow side of solitude, which can sometimes be very daunting, something we want to really get away from as soon as possible. But if we can go through those dark moments of the soul, as it were, and let that loneliness just be part of the experience, just another dimension of our humanity, when things begin to settle down, when you find you can actually embrace being alone and accept being alone, an enormous amount of rich aesthetic, emotional, and I would say kind of a wisdom too, begins to become more and more in evidence as you go through the days.
I just realized, by the way, I was 200 kilometers east of where you are. If I were 200
east, that's right. West would have been out in the Atlantic Ocean.
I was going to say I'd be in the ocean. All right. So, what are the things that you deal with? We should say that you were 10 years a monk yourself. And yes. One of the things that struck me about one of your first experiments with this, which involved hiking up to a kind of a somewhat remote ledge, I guess, in near Dharamsala. And one of the things you describe immediately is this notion that no one really knew where you were. If you were attacked by a bear, if you broke your leg, if you were bitten by a cobra, there would be no way of signaling anyone. By the way, at that point, you lost me. You lost me at bitten by cobra. I'm not going to do this thing that you did. But I think one of the things you're touching at there also is one of the first things that we feel, one of our reactions to solitude, is fear. We feel an enhanced sense of our own vulnerability that maybe is otherwise dulled once again by this noise around us. Maybe you can say a little bit about that fear and that vulnerability.
I think those kinds of levels of fear and vulnerability have very much to do with the fact that we're allowing ourselves to be in an extraordinarily raw and immediate encounter with our condition as human beings, namely that we are born and we're going to die. And this is such a profound and unavoidable reality that it sometimes takes an extreme act like going off and climbing up into the Himalayas to actually allow ourselves to feel what that's like. And I think that for many people, maybe human society in general, we could say, it spends much of its time running away from these things in a state of existential flight. And this is a way, perhaps, of coping with our existential condition, but it also is a way of rendering it somehow more superficial, somehow dishonest in a way. And solitude forces upon us a degree of self-acceptance, a degree of honesty, a degree of being forced in a way to say, yes, this is what I am. I am a fragile, vulnerable creature whose life depends on the beating of a muscle in my chest. And this can be very scary. But I think this is where the contemplative traditions come into their own, really, because by learning how to meditate, for example, you learn how to somehow get a better handle and control over your errant thoughts and your crazy emotions. And after time, it begins to settle. And in that settling, we find ourselves able to embrace what otherwise is terrifying and scary. And I think there's also no bottom to this. I think that at some level, this kind of existential fear is without any kind of end. I feel that no matter how many years you've spent in a monastery, no matter how many retreats you've done, there's something sublime in the sense of overwhelming in our humanity that can constantly be enriched and deepened with further reflections, further experiences of solitude, such that we find that although it can be frightening, at the same time, it can be profoundly enriching.
So, you know, we've talked about solitude and meditation. There are other dimensions to your book, The Art of Solitude. And before we run out of time, which we appear to be doing, I'd like to just ask you about ways in which you enhanced, perhaps, the experience of solitude with such substances as peyote and something else that I don't even know how to pronounce. But maybe talk a little bit about those mind-altering substances and what role they played.
When I turned 60, which is about the time the project of the book Art of Solitude began, I wanted to revisit some very formative experiences I'd had as a young man, and that was the taking psychedelics at the end of the 1960s, which in many ways was what prompted me, or opened my mind, let's say, to exploring non-Western philosophies, in particular Buddhism. And that's what led me, I think, in some ways to becoming a monk. And at the age of 60, I decided I wanted to return and revisit some of those formative experiences. I'd spent a long time without touching any of those things. But I wanted to do it also in a more religious setting. And so I went to Mexico. I participated in a medicine ceremony with a shaman. And subsequently, I did two ceremonies in Europe with ayahuasca, which is a plant medicine that is used in the Amazonian areas of South America. And I found that what these substances are able to invoke, and again, we mustn't take this out of context, just as important is the setting of the ceremony, the group of people with whom you do it, the guidance of the shaman, and certain other religious rituals and so on that accompany this, that these medicines, which I prefer to think of them as medicines rather than drugs, These medicines, I think, have the capacity to temporarily arrest certain deep habits of mind. And if one has already some kind of contemplative practice, I think these experiences can be used to take a very deep and a very radical look at who you are, at where your life is at, of what your life has been. In many ways, like so many of these kinds of experiences, it's very difficult to put it into words. But I found in my own case, undergoing these experiences very much served both to confirm my life in so far as I've lived it up to now, and also, curiously, they had an effect somehow that I can only describe as a sort of cleansing or purification. It's as though something was purged. And with ayahuasca in particular, part of the experience for many people is that there is literally a purging. There's a lot of vomiting and so on, which is very unpleasant. I mean, these are certainly not party drugs. They're very challenging. And many people who involved in these kinds of practices think of them as environments for work. You're working on yourself. You're working on your life. The medicine is really challenging you to open your eyes and to take stock of who you are as a human being. And I found in the course of these different ceremonies that they had served very much to free me from certain quite deep-seated attachments, one of which was to alcohol. I didn't drink a huge amount, but as you've already noted, I live in Bordeaux. The stuff comes out of the taps almost. And you know, I had a habit of drinking wine on a daily basis. After the first of the ayahuasca experiences, my body knew that I was finished with wine and beer and all of those things. And I've not touched a drop since. And that was nearly 4 years ago now. So that's one very concrete consequence of these experiences. The other was that I also found that I had to look very honestly at my relationship with Buddhism. The religion that I had, in a sense, converted to when I was 19 or 20 years old, and in which I think I had also become somehow attached and stuck and dependent on that. And the ceremonies with these medicines likewise reveal to me the extent to which I've become somewhat stuck, somewhat caught up in and dependent on these religious beliefs and doctrines that I was so interested in. And I feel that that shifted too. That was somehow released. That was somehow purged, I think is the word to use. So this too, likewise, was clearly something deeply solitary, even though I was actually physically with other people. We weren't talking, and it was something that brings you deeply into yourself. And I feel that that likewise added a very crucial and illuminating dimension of solitude that I feel constitutes the whole that I seek to portray in this book, which involves philosophy, meditation, plant medicines, and art are probably the four main themes of the book.
And we should probably stop there, other than to say that that book is The Art of Solitude. It would be a great read. It's been a great read for me. It's published by Yale University Press. A great read for me during this time of not entirely volitional solitude. And would be a great read for the rest of you as well. Although, don't try everything that Stephen tries, at least not right now, would be my advice. Stephen Batchelor has been our guest Buddhist teacher and writer, author of many books, including most recently The Art of Solitude. Thank you for your time, and do whatever you do in France when you don't drink wine, and do it with joy. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you, Colin. It's been great.
And we'll take a little break. We're going to talk some more about this. I want to talk to somebody about technology and all this, you know, solitude with Zoom and Slack and all these things dinging on my phone. I have an island. All right, we're back. We're talking about hermits and various other words that touch upon that same idea. Joining us now is Dr. Lucinda Mosher, Faculty Associate in Interfaith Studies at the Hartford Seminary. Lucinda Mosher, welcome to our conversation.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, good. That's just a little slash line through my microphone symbol on my phone here. I'm delighted to be with you today to talk about the hermit tradition.
So it seems to be a pretty consistent thing throughout theologies. I mean, across theologies. I mean, I think we've gotten kind of a taste from Stephen Batchelor about how it plays within something like Buddhism. In Hasidism, we have the Baal Shem Tov going up to the Carpathian Mountains to meditate. And obviously, in the Christian tradition, has a lot of that hermetic idea too. So what's going on there?
The Hindu and Jain traditions also, the notion of a renunciate or someone who sets themselves aside. Yes, we see that in pretty much every religious tradition. I'm a Christian, an Anglican, and so I have most knowledge about the hermit tradition in the Christian side of things, but I do have, as an instructor in interreligious studies, some depth of understanding in the others as well. But let's talk about the Christians. We can trace the hermit tradition back to about the 3rd century. The word comes from a Greek word that means of the desert, and we get that label for it because some of the early people in this who behaved in this way were in the desert in what is now Egypt. So that explains the name. Another name for it is anchorite, which comes from the Greek for withdrawing. So someone who withdraws would be an anchorite. And what we see with all of these folks is, yes, they are seeking solitude, focus, seclusion in order to focus more closely on God, but they always have an availability to the wider community. So yes, they've set themselves apart, but they are known to be a source of wisdom to others, and they are available. So it seems contradictory, but it really is not.
I mean, maybe just give us a little snapshot of one of these people. Amasera, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, Amasera, I love her. She was in the 5th century in Egypt. She dispensed wisdom quite consistently for about 60 years as a hermit in somewhere, I'm not exactly certain where, but she was near a river, so that was probably a source of sustenance for her. And her aphorisms, her sayings of wisdom, were collected in a book known as The Sayings of the Desert Fathers, but she's a desert mother. And she's one of a number that we know of that were these wise women and men who had something to say, and what they said was pithy enough that people would remember it and write it down. And then if we dial farther, one of the more fascinating ones came a little before her. He was in Syria. Simeon the Stylite is representative of a tradition of these folks who, in the Syrian context, would literally live on a pillar. They would live sort of in a treehouse-like thing, only it's, as I envision it, in the middle of an area, just a platform up in the air, which gets them out of the mainstream, but they are available. And people come to where they are and call up to them, maybe raise up food to them in a basket or something. And again, he's there to dispense wisdom. Farther, much more recent, in the 1300s, 1400s, we have Julian of Norwich, who's is called an anchorite rather than a hermit. But again, the words have similar meanings. And she lived through the bubonic plague. I think she's particularly relevant to our current situation because she knew devastating illness as a child. The bubonic plague went through Norwich, England, and she survived that. Later on in her 30s, she had some sort of a devastating illness with a tremendous Lehigh fever, and in this illness saw many visions of Jesus in his passion. So when she recovered from this illness some days later, she wrote down her visions, and this became the first book the first book by a woman surviving in, that we have it, that was written in English. So an interesting contribution to the literature. Then later on, about 20 years later, she rewrote the book, this time much more expanded, where she really philosophizes and she really asserts herself as an important theologian, her way of thinking about the human-divine relationship is strikingly beautiful. She talks about Jesus and God the Father in motherly terms. She speaks about the certainty of God's presence. So again, she's someone whose writings I will be assigning to my students when I teach a course on interreligious leadership in times of crisis that's coming up in next month at Hartford.
That should be a very popular course, given...
We are hoping so, because we think it really is needed. But her writings are really important to read in what I would call our own emergent situation, our own really difficult time. So these folks, they lived in... let me tell you a bit more about Julian. She... sometime after that serious illness in her 30s, she asked to become an anchorite. They literally performed a funeral for her, and she was part of a procession into a cell that had been built on the side of the church in the center of the town, and they walled her in there. She had a window that she could look into the church onto the altar and watch the Eucharist, as she could look at another window out into the outside world where people could come to her and ask for her counsel. And she lived in this one room cell, we're told, with her cat for the rest of her life. But again, it's a life of solitude, of centering, but she's available. And her wisdom was sought far and wide. People came to Norwich to meet with her. And we know this because of some of the other writings that mentioned this. So a really interesting way of being a spiritual leader in a difficult situation. I find her fascinating.
All right, we're going to have to pause there, although it would be fascinating. Maybe you can come back on another occasion, Lucinda.
Love to.
I think it would be fascinating also to talk to some of the people who... We're actually having a debate in this state of Connecticut right now about whether solitary confinement should ever be used on anybody, particularly the way we do it these days. And obviously one of your other areas of thought and expertise is people who've been forced into isolation as a result of their imprisonment and what that does.
And there's a difference between solitude and forced isolation. So I'd love to come back and talk about that.
That'll have to be a topic for another day. We've got one more segment to go here, and we are obeying a higher power. That would be senior producer Betsy Kaplan. So we're going to move along here, and we'll come back with more of our conversations about hermits.
One, two, three, four. Solitude stands by the window. She turns her head as I walk in the room. I can see by her eyes she's been waiting. Standing on the slant of the late afternoon.
Time for some quick thank yous and credits. First of all, Kat Pastor is, as usual, in the studio, making everything hum in a good way, and is the person who makes it possible for the rest of us to work remotely. Our gratitude knows no bounds. Our senior producer, Betsy Kaplan, is the person who put this show together. There's a rumor that Katie Tularski, who's one of the big bosses, is experiencing a birthday today. If that's true, happy birthday, Katie Tularski. And thanks to all the other people who line up behind us and make everything possible. Tomorrow, we're going to do a show about groceries. You know, you find you're kind of obsessing about groceries right now and how to shop for them and what to get. And it's not a casual thing. You're not just going to duck in somewhere and buy three or four things. It's a big deal. So we're going to talk very methodically and comprehensively about buying groceries tomorrow. Believe me, there's a lot to be said about that. We are going to continue now with our conversation about hermits. Joining us now is Karen Carper-Fredette, a cloistered nun for 30 years and has lived as a hermit for 6 years in a cabin in West Virginia, the author of several books, including Consider the Ravens on Contemporary Hermit Life. She and her husband, Paul, co-author a quarterly newsletter for hermits called Raven's Bread. Welcome to this conversation, Karen.
Well, thank you. You can hear me?
I can hear. We can hear you. I mean,
in fact,
let's start there, okay? Because, you know, everybody who's been on this show today, three people with a lot of experience with this notion of solitude and the potential for spiritual gain through solitude, everybody who's done this today has been on by Zoom. and I've got things beeping at me and clicking at me all day long in a way that, you know, a third century stylite wouldn't have had to worry about very much. So obviously you use technology to get the word out, but what's your relationship as someone who does consciously embrace solitude? What's your relationship with modern technology like?
Well, I think modern technology, if properly used, always has a place in the life of a solitary or hermit. One of the important things I want to emphasize, when people hear the word hermit, they almost unconsciously think of recluse. Mm-hmm. And a recluse and a hermit are not necessarily identified together. A recluse is more often a person who really does not like people and chooses not to be in connection with them in any way. A hermit, throughout the centuries, as we've already heard, is available to people in part for spiritual counsel. The hermits would, when the villagers needed to bring in the harvest and every hand was needed, the hermits would come out and help and then would be given a portion. So I don't see any problem with using modern devices to get the word out that there is life as a hermit that can be very, very meaningful.
So, you know, yeah, one of the things that Lucinda was talking about is that notion of that you just talked about, too, about that notion. The hermit is often seeking something. The hermit is often seeking wisdom or a purer encounter with self or a purer encounter with God. But one of the things that gets reported over and over again by people who have that experience is often that they arrive more at questions than answers. And there's this, to me, a kind of an interesting paradox between that notion of people seeking out the hermit for wisdom, you know, that Julian of Norwich would be lying in her sickbed dispensing wisdom and answering questions. Is it necessarily the case that hermits are going to have pearls of wisdom that they can drop in eager hands? Or are hermits often in purer contact with uncertainty and questions that kind of live and breathe on their own?
Well, I can speak from my own experience that once I began living hermit life alone in this cabin in West Virginia, after 30 years enclosed in a monastery, I was overwhelmed with questions. I didn't know how to deal with the real world. And gradually the experience of it, you know, I learned because I had to learn. I had, and I was the only one around to teach myself other than the Spirit of God, which had led me to find a new lifestyle at that point. One vivid moment, I was stacking the wood for the wood stove, and I turned and I saw a copperhead draped over the wood. I was about to move. And my first thought was, well, I'll leave and it will leave and then I can come back. But I didn't know where it would go. And there was no one to deal with this but myself and the Spirit of God. So I did something I'm not entirely proud of, but seemed necessary at the time. I got my double-headed axe and killed the copperhead. But what it taught me was that when you have no one to lean on but yourself, you will find the strength. And I think many of our people today who are finding themselves caught up in a kind of solitude or isolation that they're totally unprepared for. There are things you can do that will help yourself. By this time, we've all found out pretty much what is required of us. And in order to begin to make days that might be dull and uninteresting, meaningful days, we need to, first of all, establish a kind of daily schedule. A schedule that gives you many goals. They can be spiritual goals, or they can be relaxing times when you pull out books that you intended to read in the last 10 years. And by giving yourself a little framework, you begin to learn to cooperate with the gift of solitude. I don't like using the word isolation. I think solitude is a word that includes being caught up with others in many ways. As a hermit, over a period of time, you become more aware of the energies in the world around you. When we were first taught, just told the last few weeks, that we all had to stay in shelter in place, stay at home, I was aware, and I talked this over with others, of the fear and the doubt and the worry that were assaulting, literally it seemed, every person on our globe. And as a person who's aware of these kind of things, you immediately reach out for some spiritual stability. And you find that in prayer. And prayer doesn't have to be on your knees in front of a burning candle with folded hands. It's the gift of listening to what is happening in our world and bringing it to God, who is in a very special way within you, just as the divine spirit is in everybody else. And there is a connection. I mean, I am not going to personally meet ill people in China. In fact, the county that we live in the mountains of Western North Carolina, has yet to have its first case of diagnosed.
That's reassuring to hear. Unfortunately, because we move fast in radio, we have to stop there. Karen Carper-Fredette, it's been so great to talk to you. A cloistered nun for 30 years, lived as a hermit for 6 years, the author of books including Consider the Ravens on Contemporary Hermit Life. She and her husband co-author a quarterly newsletter for hermits called Raven's Bread. One thing that I would tell the rest of you is if you would be a hermit, first you must conquer your FOMO. FOMO, of course, is fear of missing out. You can't have that and be a hermit. You're not missing out on anything right now anyway. There's a pandemic. We're quarantined. All right, here we go. We're going to say goodbye, and we'll be back tomorrow with groceries.